As Guy has mentioned, I'm a bit of a last-minute ring-in. I said yes, somewhat stupidly, to speaking here today without really thinking about it. Then I spent a sleepless night wondering what I could talk about, something I could pull together very quickly without much research, because I had already had plans for every spare minute that I had here in Cambridge, as it's my former home. A few of those minutes were spent having coffee with a former colleague. I told her I'd been asked to speak and had a vague plan to talk about the point of speeches. "That was easy for you when you worked here," she said. "All your speeches had to do was inspire." "Oh yeah, that's right, too easy." Now, it's true that, living and working in Cambridge, inspiration was the easy part. I walked the cobbled streets outside here every day to my office, just where the punting starts by the bridge up the road. My back was to the window, but if I turned around, I looked out on the Cam and across at a picture postcard view of Magdalen College. With the window open, I could hear students shouting and guides giving garbled versions of local history to the tourists. I had the honour, while I was here, to interview some of the most brilliant people on the planet. I would discuss physics with Isaac Newton's successors, curate conversations on the rise of China or India, and I even got to draft a video script for Sir David Attenborough. I dabbled in history and literature, in politics, engineering and science, and medicine, and genetics, and the arts, and even sport. If stuck for the starting point of a speech, I could choose from famous graduates across 9 centuries to draw on for ideas and quotations. From Oliver Cromwell, and 2 people have already stolen my thunder on that one, who studied right here at this very college, to Douglas Adams, who was at St. John's, just around the corner, or Emma Thompson, who went to Newnham, and hundreds of others. "Cambridge was a joy," said Zadie Smith. "People reading books in posh places. It was my fantasy. I loved it. I miss it still." I once had to write a speech for the Vice Chancellor and choreograph a panel discussion on artificial intelligence. One of the panelists was a brilliant young postdoc, she was Dutch actually, whose scholarship centered on the intersection of physics and literature. In fact, she had completed her PhD on Philip Pullman's Northern Lights trilogy. I love those books, but damn it, Philip Pullman went to the other place. A joke that Guy failed to make this morning as well. And so did George Orwell. And I was having real difficulty finding a peg on which to hang the speech. As I wrapped up my preparatory interview, I moaned to the young academic that I hadn't managed to find a Cambridge writer to quote. "Oh, you should read E.M. Forster," she said. E.M. Forster, writer of Howard's End, incidentally made into a movie starring Emma Thompson, A Room with a View, staple source of Merchant Ivory movies in the 80s and 90s. Okay then. So I went off and I read E.M. Forster's rather long short story, The Machine Stops. And in it, I found an absolute treasure trove. Forster published it in 1909. And seriously, if you are asked to write about artificial intelligence or social isolation or our dystopian repressive future or blind acceptance of authority or any number of themes, this may well become your go-to source of metaphor. In 1909, when the telephone hardly existed, certainly not in the homes of ordinary people, Forster created a world where characters do not interact in person. They use something similar to FaceTime to communicate and live inside a machine that is very like the internet, a network that has swallowed communities whole. They accept creature comforts that simply arrive, suppressing the knowledge that bad things happen to those who question or want something more or try to escape. It's not a spoiler, given the title, to say that the machine stops. And as Stephen Hawking once said, success in creating AI would be the biggest event in human history. Unfortunately, it might also be the last. I sent a note to the Vice Chancellor apologising that he needed to take time out of his hectic schedule to read The Machine Stops before delivering the speech. Fortunately, he liked it, and the event went so well in 2019 that we repeated it online the following year, when the tale of people isolated and afraid to touch each other somehow resonated more than ever. Working here at Cambridge, I had no shortage of inspiration, and I poured it into my work. I'd like to think that some, at least, of the resulting words were themselves inspirational. My former colleague, who I had coffee with the other day, was really only partly right, though. Yes, my job here was to inspire, but that's true of all of us as speechwriters, isn't it? But people can be inspired by a sculpture, or a play, or a walk in the garden. They can be inspired by an athlete who has overcome the odds, or even a kitten meowing on TikTok. Inspiration, in and of itself, is not the reason we might stew over a computer until 2 or 3 in the morning, as I did this morning, trying to come up with the right words. Our speeches must have a reason beyond the words themselves. The ideas we pour onto a page are, in the main, designed to inspire our audience to act. Here at Cambridge, the purpose of a great number of the many speeches I wrote was to convince alumni and interested parties to donate to the university. Maybe not immediately, maybe not in the coming weeks, and maybe not for years. But the point was to predispose people towards philanthropy, to one day part with their hard-earned or inherited cash. 90% of the speeches I wrote had, ultimately, the same goal. The formula that I used for speeches, articles, and sometimes marketing boiled down to Cambridge plus provision of people or facilities equals save the world. Cambridge research can end cancer. Cambridge has the expertise and ability to stop climate change. Cambridge scientists can boost food production and end famine. It goes on. Depending on the audience, there are myriad ways that we can use words to inspire people. But here's the rub. It's almost impossible to know whether you've actually achieved your objective. Unless, of course, the tycoon in the front row grabs the Vice Chancellor immediately following the speech and hands over a check. I worked in the Vice Chancellor's office in Sydney University before I came to Cambridge. Our receptionist there liked to recount how a visitor arrived one day, not long before I started there, with a large package under his arm. The visitor wanted to see the Vice Chancellor to hand over the package. The visitor, an American, had seen something online about the university's work on diabetes and had decided to travel to Australia specifically to donate a painting, a Picasso painting. Security was called in case it was necessary to remove this crazy person. And yet, when the package carried so casually into the office was unwrapped, it was indeed a portrait of Picasso's lover, Marie-Thérèse Walter, and it sold a year later for well over £20 million. Someone's comms, maybe an article, maybe a social media post, who knows, maybe a speech, had done the trick but I don't know if anyone ever bothered to find out whose. My former colleague was right in another way when she said it was easy for me. My job here aligned with my ethics. In my attempts to achieve the university's goal through words, I didn't have to lie. That was something that came up in our workshop yesterday. How far do you have to go to achieve your purpose? Maybe exaggerate a little, maybe bend a story a little. Did you know there was an American called Winston Churchill who occasionally came out with a few useful phrases? But there was always plenty of genuine material here, plenty of genuine inspiration, and my personal beliefs almost always are aligned with what I was writing. And I didn't have to worry about the metrics. If my colleagues found that the speeches the Vice Chancellor delivered were inspiring, I had achieved my goal. If they, my colleagues, had only been millionaires, the words I'd written would might perhaps persuade them to dig deep. They could report back to me that the Vice Chancellor seemed happy, the audience had seemed entertained, perhaps even inspired to clap. But they couldn't really judge whether the speech had achieved its actual goal or even contributed to it. The social media team, on the other hand, had to count clicks and shares and likes. Still, perhaps, not an indication of much other than that an audience had been reached. Fundraisers totted up the pounds without knowing what had tipped the balance. Were donors inspired by the VC speech, one they'd heard while knocking back champagne? Or perhaps the inspiration was a relative dying of a rare disease, one that the donor wanted to ensure no one else ever had to suffer. Or perhaps the donor was simply attracted by the lure of a potential knighthood. Anonymous donors, like the one who gave the Picasso, are as rare as witty speeches from Donald Trump. I didn't have to worry about the ethics of the organisation, or whether the speaker was the right person for the job, or even his talent for delivery. Give or take a few events, the purpose of what I wrote was more or less the same, and if it did vary, it was always clear. I never had to ask, what's the point? And I never once thought, this is pointless. I looked out at the view or delved into my collection of Cambridge quotes. It was easy, it was a joy, and yeah, I miss it still.